Our next case this morning is case number 5-24-0846, People v. Andrew McGraw. Arguing for the appellant is attorney Andrew Moore. Arguing for the appellee is attorney Patrick Daling. Parties ready to proceed? You may proceed. If you would please state your name for the record, please, before you begin.
I am Andrew Moore, here on behalf of Andrew McGraw. Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Moore, and I represent Andrew McGraw in this appeal. I thought a lot about how to start this argument off and set the tone, but last night I kept coming back to something that Mr. McGraw told me yesterday when I visited him. I asked him, how were you able to make all the changes from the 20-year-old kid that we're talking about in this case, described in his petition, to the man he is today? He reflected on it a moment and laughed a little and shook his head and said, ain't no blueprint. There ain't no blueprint. At its highest level, that simple statement explains most of the issues in this case. There isn't a blueprint for pro se litigants to make an emerging adult claim. There aren't any blueprints for judges to follow on how to handle these cases either. We're all just doing our best. So while the courts have determined this claim was reasonably available at the time his petition is filed, the question here really is, was it reasonably available to Andrew McGraw? And that's the main contention here, whether or not Andrew McGraw can establish cause to raise his as-applied proportionate penalties claim. The state argues that Dorsey, Clark, and Moore prevent him from making that showing. And really the easiest way to discuss how McGraw can make this showing is to compare McGraw, what we know about him when his first PC was filed, and ask that question. Was it reasonable for this person to expect this person to create this claim out of whole cloth with no blueprint, given what we know about him and the factual allegations he claims that have developed since 2002 when his original PC was filed? And the first major distinction between McGraw and the defendants in Dorsey, Clark, and Moore is what we know about them at the time they were filed. McGraw's initial PC was filed way back in 2002, only a few years after his crime was committed. In his petition, unlike the defendants in Moore, Clark, and Dorsey, McGraw has alleged extensive facts for this court to work from to make that determination. Specifically, but not exclusively, just a few years prior, McGraw was assessed twice regarding his understanding of the Miranda rights. Both clinicians determined in 1998 and 1999, respectively, that he was not capable of even understanding that form to waive those rights. The assessments determined that McGraw was in the bottom 2% of his peers intellectually. He had the intellectual and developmental delays starting at birth. He was on disability starting at a very young age. And still at the age of 20, he was urinating and defecating in his pants. This is the Andrew McGraw that we're talking about. One of them. This is a man who could not read the word right, let alone create a novel legal argument from whole cloth that his rights were violated. So while the tools needed to raise this claim may have been reasonably accessible to most inmates, with what this court knows about Andrew McGraw at that time, it was not reasonably available to him. The second major distinction between cases like Dorsey, Clark, and Moore is that McGraw has extensive documentation in his petition regarding his rehabilitation since 2002. After all, the heart of Miller is the notion that youthful offenders should not be sentenced to life without parole, without first considering whether their useful traits evidence an irretrievable depravity. Here, McGraw has shown that the 20-year-old Andrew McGraw was not irretrievably depraved. He's changed his life in remarkable ways. And when you read his affidavit that he included, you can see a man with a positive and complex understanding of the issues that he faced when he was growing up.
Counsel, this court issued a decision in People v. Jones last year. It was an unpublished decision. But when I read that decision, it appears directly on point here. Why is that not, is that not accurate? How is this distinguishable?
Your Honor, it's not accurate in the sense that the things that we're talking about Andrew McGraw today weren't present in the Jones case. While Jones, this court did hold in Jones that Miller doesn't provide, Miller doesn't provide cause to raise a claim after a mandatory, the mandatory life sentence. But there are problems with the holding in Jones that are pending in the Supreme Court right now. So the distinction between mandatory and discretionary certainly isn't final, but also the Jones case didn't have the facts that are in this case. Jones was not the same person that Andrew McGraw was in 2002. And what's reasonable for most people is not reasonable for all people. And the main distinction between this and Jones is that we have distinguishing facts that show this court that it was unreasonable to expect Andrew McGraw to raise such a claim back in 2002. And that does lead into the final distinction that I'd like to make here. Since Moore is a direct, Jones is interpreting Moore, I would include Jones under any discussion of Moore as well. But the last point I'd like to make here is that the foundation of the reasoning behind the denials in Dorsey, Moore, and Clark aren't present in this case either. Unlike those defendants, Mr. McGraw didn't have the opportunity to argue that these traits, the traits that Miller identified, would have mitigated his sentence. This is important in two ways. Unlike those other defendants, his intellectual development and disabilities have never been considered, where in those cases, they were considered. So far as in Clark, where they were considered and it was determined that he should be basically kept in a padded cell his whole life. His issues were that serious. Further, in paragraph 42 in Moore, it held that the evidence for both litigants in that case showed that they were aware of proportional penalties clause arguments existed at the time of their sentencing because they were raised. So essentially, just by raising such a claim in the procedural history of a case, it basically provides the blueprint that these litigants need to be able to raise these claims, where Mr. McGraw wasn't afforded any of that. So while that distinction does get into the differences between mandatory and discretionary sentences, I think this court can decide this case even in spite of Jones because of the facts that McGraw has alleged.
Attorney Moore, can I get you to clarify something just to go back to one of the points you made? You said there are issues in the Jones case that are currently before the Supreme Court.
Yes.
What do you think those are?
It comes down to the distinction of mandatory and discretionary. And so the reasoning why I think that McGraw is distinguishable because of the fact that he wasn't able to raise these claims, that's the main tenet of those arguments in McGee, which is the Supreme Court case pending. It argues that Moore did not direct, Moore doesn't apply to mandatory sentences, Moore should only apply to discretionary. And an alternative reading of that doesn't really make sense in the context of the Moore case. And I know that you all are cited a First District case. I think it was, well, I don't remember off the top of my head, but Jones follows a First District case. But there are important distinctions between a mandatory and discretionary sentence, like the fact that these issues most of the time have already been raised in a discretionary sentence, where here they have not. But in closing, when considering whether or not to advance McGraw's petition, remember what he said about his rehabilitation journey. There isn't a blueprint as to how to do any of the things Andrew McGraw has done in his life since his crime in 1998. Similarly, there wasn't a blueprint for him to follow to raise this claim in his first petition. And if there was, considering what we know about Andrew McGraw from that time, he wouldn't have been intelligent enough to follow it. And that's why this court should hold that he has established both cause and prejudice to raise this claim now and advance his petition to an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, just a second.
No, thank you.
Questions? Thank you. We have a moment for rebuttal shortly. Attorney Daly.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Daly. I'm here on behalf of the state. I'm going to go ahead and start with the argument's been raised, and I've seen it appear in a number of decisions about discretionary versus mandatory life sentences. In this case, it was a mandatory life sentence because it involved the death of two individuals, and so Illinois law then now requires that the court impose natural life. And the argument is being made is that, well, here, you know, we have a sentencing hearing, and I think it's fairly reflected in this case, where because the parties are under the understanding of the perception, because of its mandatory nature, they don't necessarily get into a lot of the details about an individual's particular and unique characteristics and background. While that may be true, I think that what's sort of being avoided or not really being addressed when we talk about the distinction between mandatory and discretionary is that we're talking about a Illinois statutory sentencing scheme, okay? It's a reflective of a legislative intent that individuals who murder more than one individual should be serving a life sentence because of the nature, the heinousness of the crime mandates this particular result. What it doesn't mean is that it is immune, that there's been a barrier that's been raised against the sentence that's forever blocked from any kind of constitutional challenge. The whole purpose of a as-applied constitutional challenge, regardless of whether it's discretionary or mandatory, is that the unique characteristics of an individual become part of this thing that this natural life sentence shocks the conscience of the community, okay? The proportionate penalties clause, which is superior to any state legislative mandate, says that no penalties shall be upheld if they shock the conscience of the community. So when the Supreme Court in its trilogy of cases in Dorsey and Clark and Moore, you know, and if there's this sort of notion that the Supreme Court's going to have to address this distinction, such as it is, between a discretionary and a mandatory sentence, I think it has to be appreciated that the tools didn't just sort of spontaneously start with Moore. The tools, which is to attack a sentence as unconstitutionally disproportionate, have existed since the inception of the Illinois Constitution itself in the 1800s, or in those last amendment to that creation of that constitution was. So it's not, I don't think, a very valid argument to simply say, and I know this court in Jones and Horshaw, which this court relied upon, said, well, there's nothing in Clark and Dorsey, et cetera, that says anything about a different test for discretionary versus mandatory. But this is the answer. The answer is that nothing stops you from raising it. And that's it. The tools have always been there. So what are the tools? The tools are the legal tools, all right? And the Supreme Court in Clark noted that Maldonado, Centers, Adams, you know, an individual's mentality, an individual's age, these have always been considerations integral to a determination of a proportion of penalties examination, okay? So that's the legal tools. Factual tools. The factual tools in this case existed from the outset, all right? Defendant emphasizes and included in the petition for post-conviction relief, this is the second successive petition, that we'll look at these, you know, reports done by Drs. Cuneo and Raven that show cognitive deficits and intellectual low functioning. The defendant cites in his affidavit a number of environmental and background factors, which are certainly serious and are taken as true at this point. That's fine. But these are not new facts. These are facts that have always been there, and we've gone through a direct appeal. We've gone through a first post-conviction petition. okay? And now we've gone to a second post-conviction petition. Now on our second successive post-conviction petition. So these panoply of facts which exist have always been there. And so when the Supreme Court talks about the tools, the legal tools are there, the factual tools have been there, and what the Supreme Court has recognized, I think correctly, is that while Miller provided helpful support in its kind of contextual analysis of the Eighth Amendment, it's only one thing, not the thing, that would allow the defendant to make the claims that he's making right now. Helpful support is not enough to meet the rigid standard of establishing cause for the filing of a successive post-conviction petition. Now,
Justice Bolner asked about Jones, and he decided last year, and opposing counsel says many of the issues, or there are some issues from Jones that are now before the Supreme Court.
I'm not sure if that's, and there may be a PLA pending, and not Jones that I'm aware of. So, I don't know.
So do you think Jones is distinguishable? Or do you think
I think Jones is not distinguishable whatsoever. I mean, I think that Jones deals, I think, with the two salient issues that we have going on here. Number one, what's the application of the trio of cases, okay? The Moore, the Clark, and Dorsey cases, sort of reverse order. It goes into the analysis, much as the state's brief does, about how the kind of evolution of those cases dealt with, first with juvenile individuals in Dorsey. Clark moved on to intellectually impaired individuals who are childlike because of their deficits. And then in Moore, we dealt with the emerging adult, which is sort of both Clark and Moore are kind of implicated in this present case in that regard. But they all reach the same conclusion. The same conclusion is that Miller didn't provide cause to raise in a successive post-conviction petition these arguments because they could have been raised in an earlier petition. Because the tools, the legal tools, the facts, the law has always been there. And that's why the court made specific mention of the Maldonado, Sunners, and Adams cases, which predated Miller, but specifically noted, among a number of other items, that age and intellect or mentality are factors that a court can consider in determining whether a sentence is disproportionate and unconstitutional. So, and then this court, the second salient factor that it addressed was, of course, the divide, if you will, or the perception that there's a distinction between mandatory and discretionary sentences. And so that's why it sort of deferred to the Horshaw analysis, which is essentially, the court's never made that distinction. Absolutely accurate, because there is a distinction, because I said, there's nothing to prevent a defendant from raising a constitutional challenge to a sentence. Simply because the legislature has deemed a sentence is mandatory doesn't necessarily make it constitutional as applied to a particular individual. Sentences sort of regress to the mean, right? The average person who commits a crime, this is a sentence we believe that they should be seen sentenced to. A defendant like this that has a number of factors, you know, maybe that provides the tools, if you will, factually, to raise that claim that it should have been done before. Now, I do want to make one kind of mention to move on to the prejudice part. I've gone into a number of facts in the brief, and the court, I think, in its order in this case, did a nice job of sort of summarizing some of those facts. And the point of reference for the trial court here is that, well, this was an individual who's culpability was greater than just simply as an accomplice. And I think that the court's thought process on that stemmed from the perception that the Supreme Court has found that there is a difference, especially with juveniles, in impetuosity and their level of involvement in a particular crime, that there is a distinction between someone who's an accomplice and someone who's a principal. And the court says this is an individual as a principal. But there are a number of facts here which show that regardless of what the defendant's background was, this was a calculated murder. It was done for purposes of revenge. He went there. He had a target. He killed him. He laughed at the bodies as they were being led away. He bragged to the park to his friends, I told you I'd take care of that punk motherfucker. Okay? He told, apparently, according to the court, told the mom, you'd be burying your kid. All right? So sometimes, Your Honors, maybe individuals who have terrible backgrounds, and this is something that the Clark Court alluded to as well, sometimes individuals with terrible backgrounds doesn't mean that they get a sympathy verdict, or excuse me, a sympathy sentence. Maybe sometimes individuals, because of their background, make them particularly more venal and dangerous to the community. Okay? And so I think that when the court looked at this and looked at accountability versus principle and looked at the defendant's sort of actions here, the court recognized that this was not one of that rare characteristic of an individual whose mental abilities have been sort of damaged, that he became sort of willing pawns in societal pressures or whatever to commit a crime. Quite the opposite. This is an individual, perhaps because of those poor background, committed these crimes. I could sit here for 10 days and read you PSIs of individuals, of defendants who have terrible backgrounds that commit terrible crimes. Not all of them get a break. It's terrible that they have to have these lives. I feel sorry for him. I feel sorry for this defendant. But if he's the product of his environment, if he's the product of his poor background, then that would also explain why he committed a crime in such a heinous and calculated manner. So we have to look at the crime itself, not just in the context of what's his background, but what did he do? And what were the circumstances, the factual circumstances? I'm out of time, Your Honors, if I could just wrap up with one thing. I do believe that the court's analysis was proper and properly employed the trio of cases. It is on point with Jones and I think a host of other cases which have analyzed this issue identically, and I ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Questions, Justice Hackett?
Maybe I do. I should probably have asked the attorney for the appellant so that you have a chance to respond. A smaller point, but if you have any comment on this, go ahead. But as I say, it's raised in the appellant's brief, and I'll ask him about it. He says something to the effect of the defendant's claim is not reliance on Miller as the sole cause for raising the claim. You have any thoughts on that?
I do. So, and I think the way I kind of address that in the brief is Miller, well, first of all, Miller in the defendant's petition was sort of the trigger point, if you will, to raise this cause argument that I could have raised this before until Miller was decided. The defendant in their brief here cites to Miller extensively and, in fact, acknowledges that until Miller, the defendant couldn't have raised these issues. So it doesn't matter whether or not it's the sole reason or not, okay? Because all it does is it just simply adds to the body of facts which are available to the defendant at the time that he could have raised this in an earlier post-conviction petition. In other words, if you take Miller out of the equation, because Miller is the only thing, the only tether that defendants have been able to sort of attach to say, look, we have cause now. If you take Miller out of the equation, then you've got a whole litany of facts, all of which were available from the time that he was charged and convicted and sentenced. So it matters not whether you say Miller is the sole or the principal or whatever. What it comes down to is that these are the facts. They could have been raised. They weren't raised in an earlier post-conviction petition. And that really kind of settles the issue. And you'll note as well that this is an argument that I think the defendant even raised in Jones, if I'm correct, which his court rejected. And so I would obviously defer to that decision as well from your honors.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, guys.
Justice
Mulder? Thank you.
Any more rebuttal?
First of all, just to address your point, Miller isn't the sole reason for cause. You can't separate Miller from these cases. Miller provided the blueprint, as Andrew McGraw would have put it, for litigants like him to make this claim. So obviously there's been a... After that is basically the start of this area of jurisprudence. There's cases like Harris, Thompson, House that deal more specifically with emerging adults, but you can't separate the Miller construct from this claim. But Miller isn't the reason for cause. It might be part of the argument, part of why these claims are being raised now, but you can't, and this is what I have most fault with the state's argument. The state argues that nothing stopped Andrew McGraw from raising this claim. You cannot read his petition and not see a litany of barriers that would have prevented a man in his position from creating a complex legal argument. Sure, maybe in a theoretical world, somebody could have raised this argument prior to Miller. But could Andrew McGraw have done it? A man who's bottom 2% of the nation, can't even go to the bathroom properly. Is he somebody that is going to look at his case and be able to come up with this argument? That's why you can't separate his personal characteristics out of cause. And the state wants to argue that because these facts were available before sentencing, they basically disclose his ability to raise this. He should have been able to raise it then. But if those facts point to a person who's unintelligent enough to do even the most basic things, to understand Miranda, you're a lot smarter than I am. I'm guessing that you would consider Miranda rights a lot more complicated than coming up with this argument on your own. This is somebody who couldn't do that. He couldn't read the word right. So to hold... And my frustration is showing a little bit, but to hold this person accountable to raise a legal issue that wasn't even raised until almost 15 years after his PC was filed, without the ability to go through the changes that he's gone through, he's really, what he's done is exactly what judges who sentence people left want to see. They want to see somebody accept responsibility. They want to see somebody really do an analysis of their accountability and what led to their crimes and why they committed them and make the changes to not be that person anymore. He's done those things. He's done those things without the possibility of parole. So now that he's in the position to where he can think about his life and think about it in terms of where he came from, where he is now, and how things like that should have been considered, it's really like a cruel and inhumane holding to come down that theoretically because he could have done something, even though his intelligence was what it was, that discloses him from raising this claim now. And again, and just a final point, culpability. Obviously, he has a high culpability in this case. The facts of this case are not good, and he's not hiding from them, and he accepts them. But culpability is a sliding scale. It's not a bright line rule. Sure, you might have to be less. If you're less culpable, you might have to show less facts that, you know, satisfy the ultimate claim you're trying to make. But in this case, I challenge you that the facts in this case, even given his culpability, suggest that he should be able to establish cause and prejudice and advance his case to the third stage. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Justice Hackett?
No, thank you.
Justice Waller?
Okay.
I thank you. Appreciate the arguments in your briefs and the arguments you've made today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course.